Blog Talk Radio.
I'm such a loser. I announced it, I'm not going to watch this thing, man. And then I started watching it at a certain point. It was Bernie Sanders and Amy Klobuchar versus Bill Cassidy and Lindsey Graham. So the people who crafted this most recent Obamacare repeal bill. And I got some clips from it. You know, we're not going nuts here. I didn't do it as if it was, you know, how we do it when there's like a debate, when there's one that's for presidential race or something. I didn't do it like that, but I do have a few clips for you that we're going to break down. We also have later on in the show, the Fox News pastor is back, and he's chastising the people in the NFL for protesting police brutality. And then we also have big news from the Democrats. They decided to, or I should be clear, certain ones decided to take a stand against the absolute obliteration of unions in this country. So lots to talk about there. And the United States and backing dictatorships, I have an exact percentage for you. You want to talk about politically incorrect conversations, well, we will be having that later on in the show. So without further ado, let's get started here. I want to make sure we try to squeeze in as much as possible today. And we'll lead with the CNN debate. CNN had a healthcare debate last night. It was Bernie Sanders and Amy Klobuchar versus Bill Cassidy and Lindsey Graham. Of course, Cassidy and Graham are the people who drafted this most recent Obamacare repeal proposal. It's a horrendous bill. That's not just me saying it. It's virtually every expert saying it. It's the CBO and the numbers that they've crunched so far and the conclusion that they've come to. And, you know, Amy Klobuchar is a kind of a standard corporate Democrat, and Bernie Sanders is Bernie Sanders. And so you had the Democrats taking on the Republicans here. It was kind of infuriating to watch. At first, I announced I wasn't going to watch it, and then, you know, I sat there for like 20 minutes doing some prep, some work for the show, and I said, you know what, I'm going to turn this on because I needed to do some more prep anyway, and I figured let's cover this because there might be some good stuff coming out of this debate. So I have for you, first, Bill Cassidy's opening statement, because it's incredibly sad.
For 25 years, I worked in the public hospital system of Louisiana, trying to bring health care to those who did not have. And I learned in those 25 years that when the patient has the power, the system lines up to serve her. And when the bureaucrat has the power, it first serves the bureaucrat. Now, this is a debate about who has the power. Is it you, the patient, or is it the federal government? The narrative on the other side is that you don't have the capability to care for yourself, that your governor is corrupt, scheming to take away your protections if you have a pre-existing condition. And they think the federal government taking control of your life is a better way to go. The logical extension of that, unfortunately, is the Charlie Gard case. The Charlie Gard case in which the single payer of England said the decision of the life of your child is too important for the parents to make, and then the child died. I will tell you, if it's a decision about you versus the federal government, we side with you. Those who oppose us and those who want single payer, they choose otherwise. Thank you.
Senator Klo.
He is such a sleazy politician. I mean, it is dripping from his pores. It's so grotesque. So there's a lot to say about that. First of all, you're having a debate on Graham Cassidy. That's your bill. That's the Obamacare repeal bill that you guys just proposed. Notice how he conveniently didn't bring up any provisions in his own bill. He didn't discuss his own bill. He went out there and immediately started attacking single payer. Now, if I was the chief strategist for the Democrats, I would say, yummy, yummy in my tummy, this is exactly what I want, because you're attacking a proposal that 61% of the American people are in favor of, and even more Republicans support Medicare for All than oppose it. So you're attacking us on a strength, and it just so happens to be the case that every point you would make attacking Medicare for All, there's a counterargument that crushes you. So if I was the chief strategist for the Democrats, I'd say, oh, this is exactly what you want. Now let's fight and win on this front. But, of course, the majority of the Democrats still don't support Medicare for All, so they love to backpedal and they love to move away and they love to act like – they love to buy into the Republican framing and therefore lend credence to their arguments. So this is straight from the RNC talking points. We covered the story the other day that their plan to try to push through Graham Cassidy includes attacking Medicare for All. But that has nothing to do with the merits of Graham Cassidy. The reality is Obamacare, though it's deeply flawed – covered, you know, what, 20 million more people, 30 million more people. It gave people protections for pre-existing conditions. It let people stay on their parents' health insurance until they're 26 years old. It makes it so that the health insurance companies have to spend at least 80% of the money they take in on actual health care, as opposed to having these crazy ratios like 50-50, 50% for overhead, 50% for actual care. So Obamacare did a lot of good things, even though it's, you know, a half measure and it's not a great reform. So they can't respond to that, so what do? They just go out there and do bullshit Rush Limbaugh talking points against Medicare for All, which are easily debunked. So the point he makes about Charlie Gard, the right loves to do this. Hey, let me find one example of one case, misstate the facts, and blow it up as if it's, you know, indicative of this gigantic problem. And obviously in all the single-payer countries, they have the worst systems ever, and here in the U.S., we have the best system ever. Well, that's just not true at all. I mean, when you go to the studies on this, as we've brought up repeatedly, the Commonwealth Fund ranks this on a regular basis. They find that the U.S. repeatedly is worst among every developed nation when it comes to healthcare. World Health Organization has us ranked number 37 when it comes to healthcare, always dominating the top 10 are single-payer systems. But furthermore, you want to bring up an example of somebody who you think was hurt by a single-payer system. Well, guess what? 45,000 people die every year in the United States because they don't have access to basic health care. I'm going to repeat that. 45,000 people die every year in the United States because they don't have access to basic health care. So that doesn't exist in the single-payer countries. Everybody's covered. Everybody's covered. Everybody gets care. And when they talk about, oh, the wait lines, the only time you're going to wait for care is if it's an elective procedure. They prioritize and ration care based on need. We prioritize and ration care based on how rich you are. So if you're a Saudi prince, sure, you want to come to the U.S. to get your health care, because for the ultra-rich, for billionaires, we do have the best care in the world. But for your average person, you would much rather be in Canada, you would much rather be in the UK, you'd much rather be in France or Australia. And again, the studies show that they cover more people, it costs less, and they get better health outcomes. So that was nothing but fear-mongering 101. And then the final point I want to make about his opening statement here is he looks like a fucking vampire. He's an overly coached politician, and that's obvious. He comes across as wildly disingenuous, because he is. But he also looks like a vampire. He looks like Count Chocula. There's something about the guy, and this is not, you know, this doesn't mean anything particularly, because it's just based on looks. but it happens to be the reality that what he's saying matches up with his looks. But he looks like a sleazy motherfucker who's trying to get over on you. If he said nothing and I just looked at a picture, I'd be like, yeah, I'm not listening to that guy. So Bill Cassidy and Lindsey Graham, I mean, they really made asses of themselves in this debate. When you look at every expert who crunched the numbers on this, they say, okay, this is going to kick many people off of health insurance. This is going to increase premiums dramatically. You have negative consequences across the board. They pretend like this doesn't affect pre-existing conditions. That's nonsense. That's nonsense. It makes it optional on a state-by-state basis. And everybody knows that half the states are going to say we're not going to protect pre-existing conditions. All the red states are going to say we're not going to protect them. And repeatedly throughout this, they make an argument where they're like, trust the governors. What? That's an argument that they make over and over. Ooh, according to the opponents here, according to crazy socialist Bernie Sanders, if you let these governors do what they want, they're going to scheme against you and not protect pre-existing conditions. They say it as if we don't have the evidence from right before Obamacare. Right before Obamacare, protections for pre-existing conditions. And the governors did Dickie McGee's acts. They sat on their asses and said, what am I going to do about that? So you act like, you know, there isn't evidence in recent history of the governors not giving a fuck about the lack of protection for pre-existing conditions. And Bernie brings up that point. And what do they say? So I love the fact that they're attacking single payer. I just need the Democrats to go on the offense and to counter every single fucking bullshit point that they make, because their points are all horrendous. And in a debate where it's just straight facts, evidence, data, single payer versus the system we have, single payer kicks our ass up and down 97 times over. So I need everybody on the Democratic side to be as versed in, as Bernie Sanders in Medicare for All, so they could easily counter these arguments and say thank you for giving us something easy to rebut, because Medicare has a 77% approval rating, and they keep attacking it as if it's something where the Democrats should go, oh, I guess I'm going to fall back here. Why would you fall back? Again, this is a gift. It's like attacking a living wage. 80% of the American people want a living wage. If the Republicans attack it and the Democrats go, oh, well, yeah, I know, I totally agree with you, then the Democrats are beyond useless. So let's go, man. Let's go on the offense. Not only do we need to protect the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, for now and defeat Graham Cassidy, but then the next logical step is to move towards Medicare for All, because we know that that's the answer. We know it costs less and covers more people and gives us better health outcomes. Okay. Now, let's move on to Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham made a really incoherent point about Medicare in a back and forth during the debate last night. So he's going at it with Bernie Sanders, and let's see how he embarrasses himself.
We spend 12 to 18% to administer the incredibly complex hundreds of plans that we currently have. And with these guys, if they got their way, there would even be more plans, more bureaucracy, more complexity, more money going to the insurance companies. Medicare, the administration of Medicare, costs approximately 2%. So if we are serious about moving to cost-effective universal health care, yeah, we do have to take on the insurance companies. They do not play a role in providing health care. Our money should be going to doctors, to nurses, to hospitals, not to the insurance industry or, in fact, the drug industry, which is charging us by far the highest prices in the world.
Senator Graham, you were shaking your head. Is the bromance over already?
Oh, no, no. Bernie is the most honest person in the Senate because he believes in government running health care from cradle to grave. All I would say is that Medicare is coming unraveled. By 2038, the trust fund is going to run out of money. And if you're 62 like me and you've worked all your life and you're about to get on Medicare, I think it's a bad idea to have 200 of your closest friends join you, because that's Medicare for nobody.
I love how that ended, because he made the point as if it was going to have, like, a big impact, and people in the audience would be like, oh, yes, yes. But it was, like, incoherent, and everybody's like, and he's waiting for the impact. He's like, I just said the thing that you're supposed to react to, and nobody does it. And he's like, okay. What a loser. Okay, so first things first, it's just not accurate, because he's saying it's going to run out of money. It's going to run out of money. You go back, these are the same arguments that these guys were making from the inception of these programs, and they haven't run out of money. They say the same thing about Social Security. Oh, my God, Social Security is running out of money. It's running out of money. Same thing about Medicare. Oh, my God, it's running out of money. It's running out of money. What are we going to do? It's running out of money. But it doesn't run out of money. It doesn't do it. It doesn't run out of money. Every time you go back and you look at the actuary tables, it turns out, oh, it's still solvent for, you know, decades in the future. And when they say run out of money also, by the way, when you crunch the numbers, these programs pay out like 80% or 85% of what they're supposed to pay out when you hit the point decades in the future. So that's a big difference now, isn't it? They go, run out of money. Oh, actually, what I mean by that is you're still going to be able to pay out 85% of what you need to pay out. So wouldn't the logical conclusion be to take these programs, which are overwhelmingly popular, whether it's Social Security or Medicare, 77% approval rating for Medicare, the most popular health care program in the U.S., beats every other one out. Why wouldn't you make, if you needed to, in fact, make minor tweaks to fix the tiny funding gap moving forward? That's all you'd have to do, but no, they want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, and if there is any problems, go, that's it, what are we going to do? We got to get rid of it. That's what we have to do. And then, so notice, he argues it's running out of money, which it's not, but then he goes on to make the point of, well, if you're somebody like me and you're 62, you can't wait to get on Medicare, and you don't want to have 200 of your friends joining, because then it's Medicare for nobody. So it's so good and you can't wait to get on it that you don't want to share that with your friends. Huh? It's like an admission of being wildly selfish. But also the implication is, well, obviously we're not going to be able to afford it if you had 200 more people. Well, yeah, you fucking jackass, because it's not the case that when we do Medicare for All, we keep the same level of funding that we have now. No, what you do is, the current private health insurance system, all the money that you pay in premiums and copays and deductibles and all that nonsense where you get price gouged out the wazoo, so that you don't have to pay anymore, and instead that money comes out of your taxes, and in fact you net save money because you deduct the amount that you would have paid in copays and deductibles and premiums and all that stuff. So it's not, he acts like, well, you keep funding levels the same and then add everybody in the country. No, that's ridiculous. Obviously, you have mechanisms by which you raise the funds through taxes and save money in other ways in order to fund Medicare for All. They just make such bad arguments. It really is amazing. And actually, just a quick point on the previous story, because I forgot to bring it up. Bill Cassidy brings up insurance companies versus government spending, but masks it as if the question is, hey, are you going to keep the power of the people, or is the big bad government going to keep the power? But that's a lie. That's a lie, because the question isn't whether or not the people are going to keep the power or government's going to get the power when it comes to your health care and your health insurance. The question is it going to be a for-profit health insurance company that's going to have the power, or is it going to be the government? Now, again, when you look around the world, any place where it's the for-profit health insurance companies in charge, they price gouge you, they charge exorbitant rates, and they don't pay out on all the claims. The way they make money is to deny as many claims as possible. It's more expensive, you cover less people, worse outcomes, and the government happens to cover more people, cost less, better outcomes, and they do it for the smaller overhead cost. Bernie brings it up. There's a 12% or so overhead cost when it comes to private health insurance companies. It's 2% for Medicare. So it's a lie to frame it like that. It's a lie to say either the people have the power or the big bad government has the power. No, it's either the health insurance companies, for-profit health insurance companies have the power, or the government has the power. And when you have a single payer, that's a single insurer, that's the government, and it's funded through taxes, and that's it. When you have it through for-profit health insurance companies, it's unnecessary, rapacious middlemen who want to get rich off of money you're paying in for when something happens to your health. And in terms of Lindsey Graham here, they have no arguments, man, so they have to bring up shit like Medicare for all is Medicare for nobody. Really? Well, why is it that in all the other single-payer countries, everybody's covered and it costs less? I don't get it. So what do you mean? What does that mean? Medicare for all is Medicare for nobody. That's just, you're just saying words that have nothing actually attached to it. It's not true. It's not evidence-based. Look, we have to understand something about the healthcare debate in the United States of America. It is ridiculous. The so-called debate is a bunch of people who know nothing about the way the system works, or they know it, but they're lying to you because they're protecting their for-profit health insurance company donors. But it's those people versus a few people who are telling you the truth and saying, everybody knows Medicare for All is the answer. The science is in on this. So the Overton window, or the spectrum of debate in the U.S. on the issue of healthcare, is so far to the right that it's comical. And that's why people have a skewed perception and really don't understand just how screwed over we are on the issue of healthcare. Most Americans support the right idea, Medicare for All. Overwhelmingly, they do. But for the people who don't support it, they just are totally ignorant to the fact that the rest of the modern world has one version of single payer or another, and they have better outcomes and it costs less. And another thing that Lindsey Graham lied about there was how Bernie wants the government to control it cradle to grave. Well, no, because when Bernie gives the details of his ideal single-payer system, it's more of a French-style single-payer system or a Canadian-style single-payer system, not a UK-style single-payer system. So in the UK, it is public money going to public institutions and public doctors, public surgeons. So everybody is a public employee when it comes to healthcare. In France and in Canada, it is public dollars funding private institutions. So the doctors are private, you know, the actual institutions themselves are private, but it's publicly funded. So not for profit, but private institutions, public funding going to private institutions. That's what Canada has, that's what France has. UK is public everything. So there's different varieties and flavors of single payer, and Lindsey Graham is lying about the one Bernie supports because he's trying to do the boogeyman, like, ooh, you want the government to control everything. And by the way, even if Bernie did favor a UK-style single-payer system, that's still way better than what we have now in the U.S. You know, I tend to agree with Bernie that I like the Canadian and the French system a little more. But if we have the UK system, it's not like, you know, that's horrendous. No, that's one of the top-ranked systems in the world. So even with his attempt at the scaremongering talking point, it's just ridiculous. Even with trying to smear Bernie, Bernie could effectively say, yeah, that's what I want, and it's better than what we have, and he'd be right. So this debate is a non-debate, and that's why it's so maddening. Okay. All right, now let's go to the moment that exposes the Republicans in an amazing way. Bernie Sanders asked Republican Bill Cassidy if he supports negotiating with Big Pharma for lower drug prices, an idea that's so simple and so straightforward and is just flat-out common sense that you would expect if you ask a grade schooler. They go, should we negotiate for lower costs of medicine? Yes. Where's the question? But look at how Bill Cassidy shits himself and panics.
Last year, the five major pharmaceutical industries made $50 billion in profit. You got CEOs in the pharmaceutical industry who make millions and millions and millions of dollars in compensation, and one out of five Americans cannot afford the medicine they need. Are you going to join me in saying that Medicare should negotiate drug prices with the pharmaceutical industry, which is what every other major country on earth does? Are you going to join me in saying that pharmacists should be able to get the same exact medicine in Canada or abroad at a fraction of the price they have to pay for in this country? Are you on board that legislation?
I've heard Bernie say in a VA committee hearing that if we can't afford a medicine, the government should just take over the intellectual property. It should commandeer the manufacturing plants, the distribution chain. It should become the pharmaceutical company. Lindsey Graham is right. Bernie's the most honest person in the Senate. He's a socialist, and he believes it. And he believes that the creativity of the pharmaceutical industry, it's not important. Oh, we can take that, but where will the cure for Alzheimer's come from? If now when there's a cure, the pharmaceutical company knows that their profit will be commandeered. I can tell you, it's a cheap fix to commandeer, and the price is tremendous. There won't be that cure for Alzheimer's. There won't be that cure for cancer. There won't be because there was a short-term graft.
So you see what just happened right there? He pivoted and obfuscated and deflected it. Bernie goes, hey, man, well, I'm in favor of a bill. I proposed a bill that allows Medicare to negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies to make it so that we pay less for our drugs, the same drugs, we pay less for it. We're being price gouged for them. I want to make it so we are not price gouged for them. I want Medicare to be able to negotiate for better prices. I want to re-import drugs from Canada because Canada negotiates for their drug prices. And guess what? They pay less than half what we do for the same fucking drugs. In fact, many of this is our pharmaceutical companies selling to Canada for half the price. And then we have to pay at least double the price. Why the fuck would you be in favor of having the same drugs but paying way more? You're just saying I'm flat out in favor of ripping off the American people. Now, why is that the case? It's the case because Big Pharma bought the government. They bought the government. They own politicians here in the United States of America. That's what it is. So the politicians in the U.S. do sweetheart deals for their corporate donors, like people in Big Pharma. So Bernie's saying, hey, do you support cheaper drugs for the American people that are the exact same quality? That's what Bernie's asking. Do you support cheaper drugs for the American people that are the exact same quality? And what does Bill Cassidy do? He doesn't say, yes, I support that. He goes, oh, Bernie's a socialist. Socialism, big government, tyranny is going to ruin everything. He's not in favor of finding the cure for cancer. So he's smearing Bernie. Obfuscate, deflect, and smear. That's exactly what he did. You want to know why he did that? Bill Cassidy's taken about $2 million from the health industry in general. That includes private health insurance companies. That includes Big Pharma. He's taken $2 million in campaign contributions. So that $2 million buys those companies his votes, but also his smearing of Bernie Sanders on live TV and lying about Bernie Sanders. This guy is a scumbag, man. And then another point, which is total bullshit, shocker, he acts like, well, where's the cure is going to come from for Alzheimer's and cancer and stuff? Bernie wants the government to take it over, and guess what, people? No more cure for Alzheimer's or cancer. Guess what? You know where a lot of these cures come from? Government. They come from publicly funded universities. Yes. So the research and development gets done with your money, tax money, then pharmaceutical companies swoop up the rights to those drugs and price gouge the fuck out of you and charge you an arm and a leg for the drugs that you just created with your tax money. So you pay for them when you do the research because it's funded by tax money, and then the pharmaceutical companies takes it, and then they say, now let's jack up the price a tremendous amount and resell them to the American people who just created this with their own tax money and make it so that it's unaffordable. Bill Cassidy goes out there and lies. He goes, wait, where's the cure going to come from? The cure is going to come from the same fucking place it's already coming from, the publicly funded universities. They're such liars, man. They're such liars. They're corrupt, they're bought and owned, and they're liars. And they have nothing but obfuscation, deflection, and smears, because what Bernie's calling for obviously makes sense.
hey, let's pay less for the same drugs. Who could be against that? Well, apparently Bill Cassidy is against that. Okay. Let's take a break. When we come back, I got some more on Graham Cassidy. We had hearings yesterday on it. And then Democrats propose a piece of legislation to stop the crushing of unions in America. Stay right there. We'll be right back.
Thank you. on the left, real nigga left. It's like I'm on an island by myself.
Done.
The left. You will face a one bone drop you with the left. The left.
All right, I got some stuff on the hearings for you. We had hearings yesterday about the Graham Cassidy Obamacare repeal bill, and the Republicans got a little bit touchy because there were a whole bunch of protesters who were united against them. There were a lot of people who were arrested, people in wheelchairs, people who had serious medical issues who were covered by Medicaid. They were there to say, look, you can't pass this, because if you do, people like us are absolutely devastated. So protesters were united against them, and Democrats came with some tough questions. And the Republicans got all in their feels as a result of this. So let's take a look.
But I'd like
that is not true, by the way.
Well, let me.
You're entitled to your opinion. You aren't entitled.
Senator, let me just interrupt for a minute, and I'll give you the extra time. Look, I want our colleagues treated with great respect. It's not easy for him to testify on this, although it is, because he's a doctor. He understands this probably better than anybody in this room, or at least any of us. Although I was a medical liability defense lawyer, so I'm not some neophyte here. And I've probably passed more health care bills than anybody certainly in the Senate. So let's show some respect for Senator Cassidy. This is not easy for him. The fact that you disagree with him, that's fine. But he ought to be able to disagree with you.
Wow. That's such a telling clip. Because, okay, first of all, it looks like Orrin Hatch is the dad, and Bill Cassidy's like the little boy who's getting chastised by like the school teacher who's saying, you did a lot of fucked up stuff and we're going to talk about it now. And Orrin Hatch steps in and is like, well, come on now, my son means well, and you know, he's trying really hard, and let's be polite here, and let's understand it's not easy for him. And Bill Cassidy's sitting there like, thank you, Daddy. That's such a sad clip. Because it exposes something that we've spoken about before on the show, but I think this is just such a great example of it. To these Republican senators, and just, you know, more broadly, people on the right, they view morality as following tradition and decorum and politeness. So in the minds of these people, this is not an exaggeration. They don't look at a system that kicks millions of people off of their health insurance, that increases premiums dramatically, that gets rid of protections for pre-existing conditions, because that's optional under this bill, and half the states are going to get rid of the protections. They don't look at that system and go, wow, that's immoral and that's unethical. They don't do that. They don't look at the war in Iraq and go, wow, that seems pretty immoral and unethical. I mean, we killed at least 200,000 civilians. We invaded a country that didn't attack us. We destabilized an entire region. We set up a worldwide torture regime. We're holding people extrajudicially at Guantanamo, and the overwhelming majority of them are innocent and didn't do anything and are not jihadists. They don't look at any of that and go, that's immoral, that's unethical. They look at that stuff and they go, well, you know, we're good guys and we mean well. We're trying here. We're trying to do the right thing. So no, you can't judge me negatively in that respect. But God forbid somebody breaches decorum in the Senate and raises their voice. Have you no decency, sir? He's trying his hardest here. You have to be polite. So they would rather have a system where everybody's polite to each other and everybody follows proper decorum, but you also can die because you're not covered. You know, your pre-existing condition isn't covered and every health insurance company rejected you. They honestly believe it is a bigger breach of morality and ethics to get loud at a senator than it is to defend a system where people will die because they don't have medical coverage. To me, that shows you everything about these people. Because I've experienced this in my own life. where, you know, if somebody sees you getting animated and getting excited over something and saying, like, no, this is wrong, they will literally totally disregard whatever the substance is of what you're saying, focus on how you're saying what you're saying, and assume, whoa, well, you must be wrong, good sir, because look, you just used the F word. Did you just curse? Oh, my goodness. The gall on this man. Well, obviously what you're saying is wrong. I've had that happen. I've had that happen in my own life. We go, huh? So they're incapable of thinking deeply about these things and thinking about real-world effects of policy issues. In their mind, it doesn't matter if your policy effectively makes your country fascist. As long as you're polite and following decorum within that fascist society, you're a good, moral, ethical person. It really is something else, man. It really is something else. Because that is so different from, you know, the majority of people on the left who really say, I don't, decorum, politeness, what does that matter? If they're defending a system that leads to the deaths of people that are preventable deaths, why is that, why is being polite more, you know, important than fixing this fucking policy? So it is night and day. And they think that guy's tough. Please. Let me at him, man. Let me at these Republicans. And then they'll see tough. Okay. All right, now, let's go to some big news from the Democrats. We have some pretty big news here from the Democrats. Unfortunately, corporate media is not covering this nearly as much as they should. I don't think I've seen anything on this. I've only seen one article as well, and it's in New York Magazine. But look at this. On Wednesday, Democratic Senators Elizabeth Warren, Sherrod Brown, and Kirsten Gillibrand announced their agreement and introduced legislation to ban right-to-work laws throughout the United States. Quote, if we want to protect workers and expect a level playing field in international trade deals, we need to start at home, Warren told reporters Wednesday. And that means banning states from imposing restrictions that prevent workers from joining together to fight for their future. Unfortunately, those 28 right-to-work states have 56 Senate votes, so we're probably going to keep depressing North America's labor standards for the foreseeable future. Okay, so that's, I didn't know that. That's more than I thought. We have 28 right-to-work states in the United States, and right-to-work simply means right to work for less. So it's a way to crush unions and make it so that people, workers can get the benefits of unions, but then decide, I'm not going to pay my union dues. So guess what? If everybody decides, I'm going to reap the benefits of the union, but not pay your union dues, what happens? Eventually the union collapses. Because everybody stops paying their union dues, and then there's no more union at a certain point now, is there? Now isn't there. So, as a result of this, pay for workers in right-to-work states 3.2% less than pay for workers in union states. So again, right-to-work for less. You get worse benefits, less vacation time, 3.2% pay cut. So knowing the facts, any worker who's like, oh, I'm in favor of this, you've just been duped. You've been duped by the right-wing framing on this, and you're wrong as to the effects. It's going to hurt you. It's going to hurt you, without a doubt. So what Elizabeth Warren, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Sherrod Brown are saying is, let's just ban right-to-work laws, because they're anti-worker laws, and we can do labor protections at the federal level and say no more right-to-work states. And if they were to do that, a lot of people would get a raise. That's what would happen. They would increase the pay of millions and millions of workers by 3.2%. So you could thank Elizabeth Warren and Sherrod Brown and Kirsten Gillibrand if that were to get through. But of course, as they said, 56 Senate votes right now on the Republican side. So it overwhelmingly likely would not get through. But again, this is one of those issues where it shows you how the Democrats can win. Because this is such a good policy proposal that's so correct that if you do an offensive on this, the American people can't deny that, and they're going to vote for you if you push this as one of your main issues. But like I just said, most Democrats aren't talking about it, and corporate media is not even covering it. So instead, what do we get? We get endless fucking, the Democrats said this about Russia. Ooh, wow. That's not, people in fucking Arkansas aren't looking at that going, hey, here you go again, man. You better get that Vladimir Putin. He's really hurting me. No, most people are disconnected from that. That's not an argument that lands. An argument that lands is, I want to increase your pay by 3.2%. The Republicans are against it. I want to give you more vacation time. I want to give you better benefits. If we get our bill through, that's what's going to happen. Your pay is going to get increased by 3.2%. Do you want to raise by 3.2%? You do, right? Okay, vote for us. This is our bill. This is what we're pushing for. Why aren't all the Democrats on the same page and pushing for it? Why isn't corporate media covering it? You have to go in this direction. You have to. We need to make it so that unions are stronger, because when we have stronger unions, we have a stronger middle class. We lessen the burden of income inequality when we have stronger unions. We also need to push for a living wage. We also need to push for a new deal. Obviously, Medicare for All and free college helps the middle class tremendously, and also fights back against income inequality. So it's good to see the Democrats are fighting for this stuff. They just need to keep it up, keep pushing it, get the media to cover it, and then also don't do that thing where, oh, just because we're in the minority, we're going to push for it. But, oh, once we get the majority, oh, what? No, did we say we were against right to work? No, 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 we're totally for it. No. None of that tricky garbage. But look, to be fair, at least with Sherrod Brown and Elizabeth Warren, I believe them. I believe them. They're pretty populist. Elizabeth Warren's the second best senator. Everybody knows that. Sherrod Brown's not bad either. I mean, on some issues he's questionable, but most issues, especially trade issues. I think he's the senator from Ohio. So, yeah, you're not going to get elected as a Democrat in Ohio unless you're saying, let's get rid of all these fucking dumbass trade deals. And his voting record is pretty solid on these issues. So, and Kirsten Gillibrand, so-so, but, you know, if she's serious with this, good. But let's go, man. You got to push these ideas. This is how you drive the conversation, not with dumb points about, you know, Russia or whatever other nonsense corporate Democrats are pushing. Okay. All right, let's talk a little bit about foreign policy now. Truth Out released an analysis of U.S. foreign policy based on the U.S. government's own data. So this isn't, you know, hey, we got this from a contrarian source, we got it from Code Pink, let me give you the numbers. No, this is, let's go to the U.S. government's own data and figure out what's going on in terms of foreign policy. Here's what they found. According to Freedom House's rating system of political rights around the world, there were 49 nations in the world as of 2015 that can be fairly categorized as dictatorships. As of fiscal year 2015, the last year for which we have publicly available data, the federal government of the United States had been providing military assistance to 36 of them, courtesy of your tax dollars. The United States currently supports over 73% of the world's dictatorships. Wow. I have to admit, despite covering foreign policy a lot, and knowing what U.S. foreign policy is really all about, I didn't even know it was that high. That is a really, really high number. 73% of the world's dictatorships. So let's just call it for what it is here. There's no ambiguity. It's not up in the air. The talking point of we're fighting for freedom and democracy and human rights is wrong. It is comically, laughably, preposterously, hilariously wrong. Because if that were the case, we would be providing assistance to no dictatorships. None. Zero. I mean, maybe you can make an argument, hey, you know, we thought this regime was democratic, but it turns out they function more like a dictatorship. So, whoops, two or three countries slipped through the cracks, and we're providing military assistance to two or three countries that it turned out to be more dictatorial than we imagined. You can find that. I'm reasonable. You can make that argument. No, but that's not the case. It was 36 countries out of 49 that are officially categorized as dictatorships. Wow. You know, it's almost like after World War II, the United States was the only world superpower, and we decided that we were going to continue to be the world superpower, to keep that status quo going, to keep business as usual going, and to keep taking natural resources from pretty much everywhere around the world. So we don't want anybody to threaten our status as the world's sole superpower. So, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely. We're in power. We don't want to lose the power, of course. So we inherited that power. Now we got to do anything to not lose it. So if somebody threatens that, oh, no, 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 we can't have that. It allows us to keep control of the world's natural resources. When you have 900 military bases around the world at a cost of $100 billion a year to maintain, you spend more than the next 12 biggest countries combined, the next 12 biggest militaries, on our military. Largest military the world's ever seen by far and away. And you support 73% of the world's dictatorships. It's got nothing to do with altruism or human rights or justice. No, it has to do with, oh, we got to keep this going. We got to keep serving our corporate interests. We got to maintain the status quo and be the top dog. So just don't, you know, I know most of you already know this, but just don't ever come to me with, you know, the do-gooder mentality. The U.S. must save X, fill in the blank. Noam Chomsky made a great point. He said, you know, there's an easy way to prevent terrorism, right? Stop participating in it. So in other words, every time the U.S. moralizes about, oh, look at what's going on over there, he said, yeah, that's nice. That's their issue. We could feel bad for people. We could send humanitarian aid. Maybe the international community could get involved. But if you do unilateral U.S. military action, just don't. Why? Because oftentimes we are the terrorists. We are the terrorists. Tally up the body count from post-World War II until now. And then some people say, but intent. Well, really, 73% of the dictatorships we support, but you think our intent is pure? But even if our intent was pure, that's like somebody goes out on a Monday in a total accident, runs over a stranger with their car. That's manslaughter. But okay, it was an accident. What are you going to do? I mean, that's the definition of manslaughter. We killed them, but it was an accident. But in this analogy, that same person goes out of their house on Tuesday and runs over somebody. And they go out of their house on Wednesday and they run over two people. And they go out of their house on Thursday and they run over four people. And you go, you know, they go out Friday, they go out Saturday, they go out Sunday. They run over 12 people one day, 8 people another day, 6 people another day. You know, at a certain point, I do think we can question their motives and whether or not their intent really is that pure. Because if you say, oh, our intent is so pure, then why the fuck does the body count keep going up dramatically? And why are we not fixing it? Because perhaps collateral damage is barely a concern. Perhaps that's on the back burner. You know, hey, would we rather just knock out the Taliban guy? Sure. But if there's 6 or 7 innocent people there, what are we going to do? Not press the button? Who are we kidding? So they'd rather not kill those people. Hey, we killed those people. What are you going to do? It is what it is. So know what the real motivations are, man. It's business as usual, it's the status quo, it's natural resources, it's maintaining the power structure. And if that doesn't convince you, I don't know what will. Because we're backing 73% of the world's dictatorships as we scream to everybody about how we support democracy and freedom. You know, if we supported democracy and freedom, one of our top allies would not be Saudi Arabia. They're one of the least free countries on the planet. They don't allow women to drive. Women need guardians. They say all atheists are terrorists. They behead people in the public square for sorcery and witchcraft. Drug smuggling, they'll behead people for. So we can't say we support freedom and democracy, but oh yeah, this is our best friend and we're going to lose. They're massacring women and children in Yemen. What happened? I thought humanitarian, crusaders. We have to fight for human rights. Then why aren't you stopping Saudi Arabia? You're on their side killing civilians in Yemen because you don't give a fuck about human rights. You're not the world police. You are what you are. The world's sole imperialistic power, and you're acting like every other imperialistic power has ever acted throughout history. Sorry to burst some bubbles out there, but your government is not inherently good. Our motives are always so great compared to everybody else who's ever been in the same position. We're just better people. Well, your actions say otherwise. If you really were on another moral plane and you were American exceptionalist, you wouldn't be backing 73% of the world's dictatorships, and that is fucking clear. Okay. All right, let's take our final break, and then when we come back, we got the Fox News pastor is at it again. And Anthony Weiner, oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Poor guy. He's in trouble. He's in quite a bit of trouble. All right, stay there. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
fake, so I'm gonna drop you with the left, the left. I feel like I'm the left, real nigga, left, the left.
It's son of a bitch, all right, we're back, y'all.
Okay. This next story has an infographic, so I'm going to have to, I believe, read it to you. It's not that long. It's pretty short, but it gives a lot of relevant information. Human Rights Watch has some new information for us about U.S. war crimes. In this case, it's in Syria. Let's take a look. Near Raqqa, U.S.-led airstrikes against ISIS killed dozens of civilians. One hit a school building, at least 40 civilians killed, including 16 kids. Another hit a public market, at least 44 civilians killed, including 14 kids. And then it says they need to conduct an investigation. Why do they hate us? Look, man, okay, so that does trivialize it a little bit because it is complicated as to why they hate us. There's different motivations for different people. Some people, you are dealing with a situation where, hey, you killed my uncle, and it's pure revenge. Other people, yes, they're radicalized by fundamentalist Islam. There's no denying that that's a huge factor as well. But wouldn't it be great if we weren't involved in countries that didn't attack us and you could leave the fighting to the people in the region who are the first targets of the bad guys? You know, ISIS and Al-Qaeda and jihadists have been fighting in Syria. They've been going there like a fucking bug light. And the Syrian government has been fighting them back, and Hezbollah has been fighting them as well. And instead of, the U.S. not being involved and perhaps backing the side that aren't jihadists with humanitarian aid or what have you, instead of doing that, we are involved and we're bombing both sides. In fact, there was a story a while ago that wasn't nearly as big as it should have been, that I think it was the LA Times, and they found that CIA-backed fighters in Syria are fighting Pentagon-backed fighters. So we're arming both sides of the same war. We're also attacking both sides. Trump has repeatedly bombed the Syrian government, Syrian-backed troops. And then we also, every now and then, bomb the rebels, because the rebels are mostly jihadists at this point. So this is the definition of a quagmire. We're on both sides of the same fight. And again, let me ask everybody, what's victory? Because the U.S. says, hey, we despise Assad, who's the leader in Syria. But then we also say we despise the rebels because the rebels, now we admit, are mostly jihadists. So if you're not going to be happy if Assad wins and you're not going to be happy if the rebels win, then why the fuck are you involved? What are you trying to do? Seriously, what are you trying to do? I think what the answer is having some sort of Sunni government. So Assad is Shia Alawite, but some sort of Sunni government that's beholden to Saudi Arabia. So they can be Salafists, but they have to be somewhat tameable, willing to do business with Saudi Arabia and the U.S. and be another puppet of ours like Saudi Arabia is. That's what I think is going on, but you're not going to find that path. Because the people who are fighting in Syria right now on the side of the jihadists are the real Kool-Aid drinkers. They haven't just dipped their toes in the Salafi waters. They're all in. So they hate America, you know, just as much as they hate the Jews and the atheists and all the infidels, and they want to see death to America. So you're playing with fucking fire. That's what you're doing. And in the meantime, while we're there doing all these things, look at that. Oops, we killed a whole bunch of children and a whole bunch of civilians, and yet again managed to be the worst character on the block in a war where there's nothing but monsters. Just get the fuck out, man. Get the fuck out. Mind our business. They didn't attack us. They used to have to at least pretend like there was some sort of direct threat against the U.S. Now they don't. You know, with Iraq, oh, Saddam's going to attack us. It was bullshit. But they knew back then we have to at least have the rationale that somebody's going to attack us to get the war feelings bubbling over. But now they're just, fuck it, we're in Syria, and we're not even pretending like Assad's going to attack us, or, you know, it's not like ISIS is on the verge of attacking us. These are fighters who are in Syria because they're focused first on Assad. So why the fuck are we there? So stupid, so dumb, breeding more hatred against us. It's schizophrenic because we don't even know what fucking side we're on. Just get the fuck out and stop wasting our tax money. Nobody ever says, hey, what's going on here? Really? We're just going to waste money in Syria and fighting both sides and arming both sides? What the fuck's happening? What is this? We can't afford health care here? We can't afford free college? When the polls show people want both those things, we can't have a living wage here? We can't do a new deal and rebuild our infrastructure, which gets a grade of D+, but you have money to fight on both sides in Syria. And this is the result. Civilians dying all over the place, children dying all over the place. Well done. Okay. All right, now. Let's go to the Fox News pastor. He's at it again. Fox News pastor and Donald Trump advisor Robert Jeffers spoke about the NFL protests on Fox News, and boy, did he make a wild claim.
I think what these players are doing is absolutely wrong. These players ought to be thanking God that they live in a country where they're not only free to earn millions of dollars every year, but they're also free from the worry of being shot in the head for taking a knee like they would be if they were in North Korea. And I think tens of... millions of Americans agree with President Trump when he says they ought to be called out for this. I know this president. President Trump is not a racist. For President Trump, this is not about race. Effective countries.
Wow. That is the hottest of all hot takes I think I've ever heard. That is a fucking flaming nuclear radioactive take right there. Okay, so the NFL protesters shouldn't protest. Instead, they should be thanking God they live in a country where they don't get shot in the head for the freedom to protest. They should be thanking God they don't live in North Korea. You want to talk about a low bar. Hey, look, guys, we're not North Korea, huh? Yeah, and here... we allow dissent, which is the exact thing you're telling them not to do. Hey, look, don't exercise your freedom because you live in a country that has that allows you to exercise it. What? What kind of reverse psychology bullshit is that? No, if they can exercise their freedom, and they can, why wouldn't they exercise their freedom, their First Amendment rights, to try to shine a light on what this all was originally about, which is police brutality and injustice. I mean, the arguments, the tortured, twisted arguments these people come up with to try to say it's bad what they're doing. Meanwhile, these are the same fucking people who didn't call it un-American to defend the Confederate flag and Confederate monuments. Confederate flag and Confederate monuments, literal signs of traitors to this country. We want to secede because we don't like the United States of America. We want to keep slavery. So we are traitors, we are secessionists, we're going to leave over this. People were just flying the Confederate flags. They defend the Confederate flags, and they turn around today and pretend to be the most American. You know, if you were the most American, perhaps you would have at least been honest about what the Confederate flag stood for. But you didn't. Somehow the people who defend the Confederate flag the most have wrapped themselves in the American flag the most, and they say, yes. We're the most American, even though we were just literally flying the flags of traitors. Dissent is the highest form of patriotism. If they want to take a knee to try to make the country better by limiting police brutality and fixing injustice, there's nothing more American than that. And, you know, it's been driving me crazy, the hypocrisy on this, because there's so many people on the right who pretend like their main issue is free speech and free expression,
and that they're crusaders for it, and that, oh my God, all the fucking college campus snowflakes trying to, the left-wingers who are authoritarians, who are trying to shut down right-wing talkers, we're principled in our defense of free speech, except they're not. Because if they were, they would have all defended Chelsea Manning when she got disinvited from Harvard. And they didn't. They would have all said, you know what, even if I don't agree with Colin Kaepernick, he shouldn't get fucking fired. And nobody who's kneeling in the NFL should get fired for kneeling, because that is the definition of a nonviolent, peaceful protest. That's as American as it gets. And the president of the United States, who represents the government, said, you should get fired for that. How is that not a violation of the First Amendment? The government, the president, saying you should get fired if you, do free expression and free speech. So they're hypocrites. They're hypocrites. And then, by the way, this guy Robert Jeffers goes on to say, I don't think Jesus would do this. This is the same guy who we just covered the story, not even a week ago, of him saying, oh, yeah, when it comes to immigration, sure, Jesus wants you to do, what's right by immigrants. But then again, we're secular, so don't, it's separate church and state. I wouldn't worry too much. Don't be too compassionate here when it comes to immigrants. So notice, when the argument is convenient, oh, no, we're secular. They ignore what Jesus said. And then now when he thinks Jesus wouldn't kneel, which I don't even know where he's getting that from, he goes, oh, what would Jesus do? Follow what Jesus would do. They're just, the far-right politics comes before everything else in their mind. That's what it is. That he's not, oh, I'm going to worry about Jesus or the Bible or my religion or being a good person. That is not higher on his list. Higher on his list is, I'm going to be a right-wing hack. And what are the right-wingers saying? Okay, let me make that argument. So now, oh, the fucking football players, geez, taking a knee and, like, using your freedoms. And you should just be happy we're not shooting you in the head like in North Korea. How is that an argument that's remotely convincing to anybody? We're not North Korea. Therefore, don't exercise your freedoms because we're not North Korea. Insane. All right, next. Former Congressman Anthony Weiner is going to prison. Hot diggity damn. So this is from the Washington Post. Disgraced former U.S. Congressman Anthony Weiner, whose exchange of illicit messages with a teenager wound up playing a role in the 2016 presidential election, was sentenced Monday to 21 months in prison. Damn, authorities said. The penalty marks a stunning downfall for the New York Democrat, whose propensity for sending lewd photos to women repeatedly derailed his career in politics, and in a roundabout way, might also have affected Hillary Clinton's bid to become president. It was federal authorities' investigation of Weiner that led them to emails of his wife, top Clinton aide Huma Abedin, and the discovery of those emails ultimately caused the FBI, as the election campaign drew to a close, to reopen the probe of Clinton's use of a private email server. Weiner, 53, pleaded guilty in May to transferring obscene material to a minor, stemming from interactions he had with a 15-year-old who later described the exchanges and released images to the Daily Mail. Damn. This fucking guy, man. Holy shit, this fucking guy. He can't stop sexting people. And this, it's actually not funny. I shouldn't be laughing because she was 15, the one where he's going to jail. 15 years old. Look, people, if you listen to this show, you know my take on all this stuff. I think the legal age for everything should be 16. But even according to my liberal-as-fuck standard, she's 15. She's under that line. So he's sexting a 15-year-old. Yeah, that's a crime. And he knew. It's not like she tricked him. He knew that she's 15. He is like a walking advertisement for the idea that sex addiction is real, even though he wasn't having sex with any of these women. It was all sexting and phone sex, text sex, or whatever it was, but he was trying to do it with everybody. Carlos Danger was his alternate persona online. Like, dude, you were a fucking congressman.
That's dangerous enough. You don't need to put a goofy-ass name to it. And Carlos, why Carlos? I don't get it. And, yeah, so what they're saying about the election is he had emails on a computer that I guess authorities in the FBI, when they were doing Hillary Clinton's email server investigation, they had seen emails from Huma Abedin and Hillary Clinton on this computer, which they didn't look at in the previous investigation before they closed it. So then they said, oh, shit, there's more emails here going back and forth with Hillary Clinton from this device, so now we got to reopen the investigation. Now, you could say, well, you know, hey, I think Comey had a political axe to grind, and, you know, he was trying to hurt Hillary Clinton by mentioning this publicly. But that was the point that the FBI was making, was, hey, we stumbled across these emails that were with Hillary Clinton that weren't looked at in the previous investigation, so now we're going to have to reopen it, and it's because there was an investigation into Anthony Weiner, and then they stumbled across Huma Abedin's emails with Hillary Clinton that were not previously looked at. So, Jesus, this is the man who, I mean, imagine in his own mind, and in the mind of everybody he runs with, because this guy's deep in corporate Democrat circles, they think, like, oh, Anthony Weiner lost the election for Hillary Clinton, and he got caught sexting a 15-year-old after he had already been caught in sexting scandals, where is why he lost, was running in 2013 for governor of New York. A scandal broke at that time. He got caught again sexting. So sexting everybody in sight, sexting a minor, and lost the presidential election for Hillary Clinton. Oh. You know, they did a really good documentary on Anthony Weiner. I think it was Showtime that did it, but I could be wrong. And they shouldn't have done it that early, because they had more. Now there's more stuff to add. He put his hands in his head and on his head and started crying when he got the news. He was sentenced to 21 months in prison. Shit. Well, this is what happens. So usually elites, there's no punishment for elites. I mean, let's be serious. There's very rarely punishment for elites, okay? But this is what happens when you've worn out your welcome in elite circles, and then you get caught with something. You want to talk about a fall from grace. He was a congressman who kicked ass when he was a congressman. There are countless clips of him on the floor of Congress yelling at Republicans, shutting them down, making decent points from time to time. And then the biggest fall from grace ever, his name was floated as maybe senator, maybe president. And then now look at where he is. It's a story for the ages. But in all seriousness, the dude does need help, you know, because this is, if you can't fucking stop, when that's the thing that ruins your career, and then you can't fucking stop, as he was trying to make a comeback. I know this ruined me, but now I'm going to try to make a comeback and keep doing the thing that I got caught doing that I said, oh, I'm sorry about. And you did it with a 15-year-old. Woo. He's got major, major, major issues. Okay. All right, final story of the day, everybody. Here's a creepy story for everybody. Texas parents send 7-year-old packing because they think he's possessed by demons. Wow. Can you imagine kicking your 7-year-old kid out of your house? I mean, that is just monstrous. I can't fathom that. That's so wild, man. Wow. Kicked a 7-year-old out of their house. Their names are Ronald Keith and Rendy Wright. Now, get this. It's not just that they're lunatics and they did this. Their pastor told them that the kid was possessed. So this was like, you know, the old saying, oh, it takes a village to, like, raise kids, raise people. Well, here's the village said, that's a demon. And then they kicked a 7-year-old out of 7-year-old, every time I think about it. That's because that's not possible to live as a 17-year-old. It's just not. It's hard enough if somebody gets kicked out when they're fucking 18. Kicked out when 7 years old. What? Because the pastor was like, that's a demon right there. Think about how many layers of crazy this is. The pastor says there's no evidence demons are real. Never mind demons existing. Never mind this specific kid being a demon. But the pastor and the parents are like, demon, be gone with you. So the pastor told them that he was possessed. They said, well, yeah, he's possessed. He was also disobedient. Oh, so you're also just douchebag parents. I don't like that my kid isn't listening to me, so now we're going to banish you. What the fuck kind of shit is that? But then here's the plot twist. Ready for this? They admitted to doing meth. Have you considered that maybe the reason you think your kid is a demon is because your ass is tweaking on meth, son? Have you considered that? Hey, maybe I'm fucking high off my ass cheeks and I think my kid's a demon, but what? That's a crazy thought. My kid's obviously not a demon. I'm high as fuck. No, kick out the kid. And the thing that I'm having trouble wrapping my mind around is, but the pastor told them the kid was a demon too. So the pastor said it, but they agreed, but they were high on meth. Was the pastor high on meth? Look, either way, take this kid, and I think they did this, take the kid, put him with relatives who are sane people, because this is not okay. And can you imagine being Ronald Keith and Rendy Wright? I mean, useless scumbags who kicking their 7-year-old out of the house, believe in demons, smoking meth all day. It's horrendous people, man. That's who they are. And I feel horrible. What kind of a life is this 7-year-old going to have now? Like, oh, you're... When this kid is older. Oh, remember when your mom and dad thought you were a demon and they kicked you out of the house? That family reunion is going to be one hell of a weird situation now, isn't it? So, this story just blows me away. It just fucking blows me. I can't believe it. So many fucked up things going on out there. It's hard to wrap your mind around a lot of this stuff, but there you have it. 7-year-old kicked out of his house for being a demon by a pastor who agreed with the parents. There's a lot of fucked up angles to this story. But yeah, keep it real also. The fact that religion gave the pastor the angle to, like, throw his weight behind the parents and say, yeah, it's a demon. Really doing the Lord's work there, buddy. That's exactly what Jesus would want. Because these people are Christians. That's exactly what Jesus wants. Thou shalt kicketh out your 7-year-old and make him suffer. Really fits in well with the overwhelming majority of the New Testament, which is about compassion and love. Okay. Oh, would you look at that? We're done. We're done 5 minutes early. Interesting. All right, guys. I love y'all. And I think we got Kyle and Corin tomorrow. And then we're back live Thursday. Everybody enjoy the rest of your day. I can't wait for this hot weather to pass. It's been hot as fuck in New York. But anyway, love you guys. And we'll see you tomorrow with Kyle and Corin. Peace.